Welcome to the Hospitality Maverick podcast with me, Michael Tinkser. We at Hospitality Mavericks are here to inspire leaders to create heart-centered and profitable businesses from the inside out, the kind that both employees and customers love and support. Thanks to BizSimply for sponsoring this episode as our show partner, and BizSimply is the all-in-one HR, workforce management, rote and operations software designed and built by hospitality experts to make every shift run like clockwork. And we join forces to help the industry find new ways to become even more innovative in how we lead our people, how we operate, to how we grow our businesses, to how we serve our customers. Together, we want to share strategies and tools that can make the industry thrive long term, not just survive.
To the leaders and the managing directors out there, go to the right at the beginning of your supply chain and find that one farmer or one grower who has his eyes wide open, who wants to transition, and go on that journey with him. Make it happen. Do it. And then from that, when you've completed that, then bring all the other farmers and all the other growers to that farm and show them the real benefits of it, but also the real challenges around doing it.
I'm a big believer, and I know it's true when I've observed Maverick leaders. They know and do things that makes incredible impact on people, community, and the planet. And today's guest is a great example on amplifying this. Please meet Dr. Vincent Walls, who is a leading circular, regenerative food and agriculture expert here in the UK. He's a consultant to some of the biggest UK food and beverage companies and is supporting them on projects and product development aligned to their net zero targets and how they want to make an everlasting positive dent on our food system. Current clients include food service businesses such as Levy UK and Ireland and the food division of the Quorn brand. Today, he shares his journey, insights, and his aspirations with you. We discover what actually ignited Vincent's passion for circular and regenerative food and agriculture, and leading him to embrace and champion these principles in everything he do. He shares with us the importance of understanding the history of nature's evolution and why it's important to understand when it comes to on our food systems and the impact they have on the climate today. He gives us some great standout examples from his work that clarify the potential of circular regenerative practices in transforming our food systems. Join us as we unpack the complexity of our current food system, exploring the pathway to more sustainable and regenerative systems. This episode is not just a conversation, it's a call to action for all of us in hospitality and beyond to rethink and reimagine and build our food systems for the betterment of our planet and future generations. If you like today's episode, it'll mean the world to me if you can leave a review of the show, either on our website, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. The better the reviews, the better the guest, and ultimately, the better the learning is for you. I will, if I was you, listen to this episode while you are able to make notes, because this will influence your strategic thinking for how you can run a business that is successful but also make massive impact. So let me know what you learned from listening in to this conversation, and more important, what made it change in your thinking, and more important, what does it change in how you do business. Let's just dive in and be Maverick. It's not every day we hear on the podcast are going to be taking a deep dive into, probably for many as for myself, still an area to learn a lot. It's a deep dive into circular and regenerative food and agriculture, and meeting a person that's really putting the money where the mouth is and their work. They are not just talking about it from a insights research point of view, but also actually putting not just one, but three different organizations / businesses to live, to actually live out the whole idea around this. So with that said, welcome to the show, Dr. Vincent.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me. Looking forward to it.
It's absolutely great that you said yes to this, because I think I'm so fascinated about, you know, you must be the most busiest man in the world when I see all the things you're involved in and all the progress you do. So it'd be really great for people just to get an idea about, like, you know, who are you? What is your journey to actually where you are today? And what are you involved in today actually to live that purpose?
Well, yeah, it's probably worth saying my background's based in design. So very early on, like I did my undergrad in move and image design, which was kind of, you know, doing title sequences and so on. And then I moved into more kind of my master's in kind of art, studied architecture, kind of in particularly biological architecture. And then kind of my PhD was more kind of looking at biospheric systems. But all my work is being action led. I think it's worth saying that, you know, double dyslexia, Erlang syndrome and dyspraxia. And therefore, you know, very difficult kind of reading and so on. And therefore, you know, all my work has always been action led, on the ground doing stuff. Even for example, in my master's, you know, what I did is very quickly I took over a large garden, and I started building a kind of ecosystem. And then even for my PhD, you know, raised, you know, thousands of pounds, actually £850,000 to do my PhD. And the reason I needed that money is because I wanted to take over a building and start developing a range of ecological systems in that building. And therefore it's always been about doing stuff on the ground for me. Particularly because I found, you know, academia so difficult. But I am, you know, I've got a PhD, and some people always think, how do you square that, you know, with, you know, your dyslexia and Erlang syndrome dyspraxia and how you ended up with a PhD. I've not got a PhD because I'm a great reader. I've got a PhD because I like doing stuff. So all my work around circular and regenerative infrastructure is all about doing stuff on the ground, not talking about it, not developing strategic documents for companies, just, hey, if you're interested in what I do, let's do stuff on the ground and build ecosystems and so on.
Yeah, and that was also the impression I got. And thank you for sharing your journey as well and the challenges. I have somebody very close to me that suffer from the same. So I know how hard it is actually to adapt to the normal world. And you talk about academia. You talk about academia at the highest level with these challenges. Can you talk a bit about, you know, why you've taken, you know, your focus as you have today? What was the tipping point that made you say, this is what I need to do? I need to go and do this, because you talk about doing in principle. Why was it that you have to go and do this?
It's really interesting actually, because, you know, all my background, all my work has actually been around food. You know, I didn't grow up really with, you know, a great understanding of cuisine or great food, to be honest. You know, my mum grew, you know, I'm from a single parent family from a place in south of Manchester, kind of council estate. And my mum, you know, brought the four of us up very well, but, you know, we weren't a massive foodie family. So it's quite strange why I've always had a focus on food, and that focus was very 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 early. Even in my BA honours, for my exhibition, you know, your third year exhibition at the end of the BA honours, what I did is for that I did a homeless documentary in New York, San Francisco, and Chicago. So I left Manchester with $75. With a prepaid ticket, and what I wanted to do is live in each state for 4 to 6 weeks on the streets, and to understand how homeless people live and how they access food. So from very, very, and that was no holiday, Michael. You know, nope, that's a very difficult thing to do. And I could speak about 2 hours just on that, but I won't go into it. But what I'm trying to tell you is, for some reason, there's always been a connection with food in my work. And that's come from very, very early on. Why is that? I don't really know. But it is what it is. So yeah, there's been a, you know, with all my work through my academia, and now what I do professionally, it's really all about, you know, regenerative, circular, sustainable, ecological food.
Yeah, and talk a bit about the work you do now, and how you actually are trying to influence, you know, different areas of the food system in principle.
Yeah, so, you know, let's quickly speak about kind of circular and regenerative concepts and where they come from, and this is my own perspective. The biosphere, the region of the Earth system, you know, the complexity, the ecological life support system that enables all living things to be here. Well, that journey started very, very, very early on within kind of Earth system science. So it's interesting to me that, you know, water rendezvoused with the biosphere or the Earth system. I think it was 4.5 billion years ago, for example. And then interestingly, the next significant thing for me was photosynthesis. Now, photosynthesis came around 3.5 billion years, 3.4 billion years ago. And then when did fungus rendezvous with the biosphere? Well, fungus rendezvoused with the biosphere about 1.4, 1.5 billion years ago. And then when did soil rendezvous with the biosphere? Only 450 million years ago. You know, it's very, 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 very young, actually, you know. So firstly, and the reason I'm saying that is you hear a lot, it all starts with soil when it comes to food. And I just don't believe that. There's something significant happens way before soil. And we see that, how the biosphere has evolved. And when did the Earth system become circular? Well, I would argue the Earth system started its circular journey when photosynthesis happened, when the chemical process, you know, of, you know, our Earth system is energetically open to the sun and materially closed. That's why we call it an energetically open and materially closed ecological life support system, because that's exactly what it is. So I would argue that our Earth system became circular very early through photosynthesis. That was the kickstart of the chemical process of energy from the sun. That energy then beams down onto the Earth system, and then that starts a number of chemical and biological reactions that enables our system then to grow forests, complex ecosystems that put carbon in the soil, you know, and then all the chemical processes came from that. And that system is circular. And when I say circular, I mean it continuously upcycles. Yeah, it doesn't downcycle. You know, what recycling is downcycling. Mm. Yeah. So, you know, when you look at kind of, when we say recycling, let me take an example. If, you know, a car, when a car, it comes to its end of its life, the plastic in that car will first be get turned into a bench. Then when that bench comes to its end of its life, that bench will get turned into a toothbrush. At the end of that life, that then will get turned into a toothpick. Inevitably, that toothpick is going to end up in landfill.
Mm.
What we're doing is slowly downcycling, and that's what we call recycling. Recycling is a human-made concept.
Mm.
Upcycling is something the biosphere does. Humans recycle, the biosphere upcycles, and evidently it does upcycle, because if it didn't upcycle, i.e. every time it goes through its cycle, we end up with the same value of material, yeah, or even better processes from that, more valuable processes, for example. You know, so when I think of circular systems, what I'm talking about is the capability of upcycling. And what upcycling is, what all circular systems do, is generate positive feedback loops. That's what an ecosystem does. And without positive feedback loops, you cannot build a regenerative system. Therefore, you cannot have a regenerative system that is not circular in terms of ecological and biological knowledge. as we have it today. So what I try to do with my, and I think it's important to say that.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people think that recycling is good. And in some concepts, it can be good. But actually, we only can recycle because the product is designed poorly. You can recycle a plastic bottle, but you can't upcycle a plastic bottle. When you recycle it, the value of that plastic bottle, the value of that material has declined. It hasn't increased. And therefore, design is highly important, because if you design a product which is circular, which is metabolic, which has living principles within it, and therefore then it can be upcycled. It can, you could design a plastic bottle, or not a plastic bottle, but a bottle which could hold liquid in the future, where when you finish with that product, all you need to do is throw it in the soil and it'll decompose and it'll turn back into soil. That's a system which I think is more around upcycling. At the moment, we don't do that with our plastic bottles because they're designed poorly. We can only recycle. We can't upcycle. Now, in terms of biological understanding, when you're thinking about farms, I think we need to mimic them principles. I think if you want a sustainable, adaptive, ecological farm, what you need is a farm which can continually upcycle. And what I mean by upcycling is you need continuous feedback loops. And that feedback loop is the feedback loop that enables a regenerative system. Let me put that the other way. Why could a pesticide system never be regenerative? Because it hasn't got the complexity within the system to be regenerative. Because the idea of a pesticide, herbicide, insecticide is not to work with nature, it's to control nature. Mm. It's to put crop in the field and drench that crop with pesticide, herbicide, insecticide. What are pesticides, herbicide, insecticide doing? They're doing one thing. They're killing everything except the crops that you're trying to produce. Nature has never designed in that way. It would never design in that way. And if it did design in that way, we would not be here. Because the complexity of the system enables us to be here. Without that complexity, we would not be here. So it took about 120 million years from early plants to forest systems. 120 million years. We needed it, and it took that lot longer to connect the genetic code, to create the layers, the stratas of woodlands and forest systems, to create the whole variety of worms, termites, ants, bees, and all them specialized, highly specialized, not accidental. When you look at the anatomy of a bee and what it does, it's not accidental. It's highly designed. That's why Richard Dawkins called one of his books The Blind Watchmaker. And what he was referring there to, the blind watchmaker, was this watch is evidently highly designed, or the ecosystem's highly designed. Yeah, but the blind watchmaker, he's trying to understand that there wasn't a God that designed them systems. It's evolution over natural selection, Darwinism and neo-Darwinism and so on. What I'm trying to tell you, Michael, is the principles of circular and regenerative systems are well-defined, and they're well-defined before we were here, because we did not create them. The ecosystem, the complex ecological life support system created them. And my work, back to your question, my work is about mimicking them systems. Actually, I don't have to actually even understand them in detail. I do understand them in detail, but I don't need to. What you need to understand is that a system works. And all we need to do is mimic them systems. And when I speak about systems, what I'm talking about in my work is ecosystems. Ecosystems that produce food.
It's super interesting, Vincent. I made a lot of notes as you were talking, because again, there was lots of things that was like, that brought my understanding together, because I've written a number of different things, but actually you gave the full lowdown, and actually thinking about it, actually how it's built. And I actually didn't know there were so many million years between these different things. But coming back to one thing that's very hot on the agenda, I was something this week where soil health, and you're saying, well, it's not really about soil health, because everybody talking about we fix the soil, we in principle fix many of the challenges we have. So what you're saying is that it's not enough to fix the soil.
No, okay, yeah, it's a good question. So what I'm saying is it's we definitely have to fix the soil, because we want to transition to a system which is not pesticide heavy, and therefore you're not killing everything in the soil. We want a system which is the complete opposite, that which is biodiverse, which is rich, because if we have rich soils, we can put lots of carbon in the soil. We have the ability to increase biodiversity. We have the ability to better water hydrology management, etc. But what I'm trying to say is actually it's one of the last things I think about when designing an ecosystem, because what I think about when I'm designing an ecosystem is the layers and the stratas of that system. For example, in the UK, our woodlands or forests, young woodlands mainly, are based on around 7 layers, for example. That's what our ecosystem is based on. So when I'm designing a food ecosystem, I think about them 7 layers. Mm. So for example, I'll just run through them layers quickly. So on the top layer, what I might do is I might put a nitrofixing tree in. So at the moment, where does our nitrogen come from in traditional farming systems? We mine it. We mine it, and then we export it globally. Most of our nitrogen in the UK was coming from Ukraine before the war, for example. Now, that's one way of putting nitrogen, because all systems need nitrogen. Well, again, the biosphere has worked that out a long time ago. So the biosphere has learned how to develop plants that can take nitrogen out the sky, out the air, and fix nitrogen in the soil. How much nitrogen are we breathing now? About 79%. Nitrogen is everywhere. The only thing is it's invisible. If it was red, you know, it'll be, you know, with we probably wouldn't need to see each other. It's everywhere, nitrogen. So and the plants have worked that out billions of years ago. Actually, nitrogen is needed for ecosystems to put into to the ground. So that would be, for example, the first layer. Underneath that, then what we might have is then a number of production trees like apples, pears, dancing, quinces, gages. And then underneath that, then we'll have our shrubs and so on. You know, so that could be stuff like blackberries, blackcurrants, elderberries, for example. And then underneath that, you want your herbs and your perennial layers. And then underneath that, you want your ground cover layers. Yeah, and then underneath that, you know, you want worms, and you want particularly oyster mushrooms in the UK, because they're the fastest decomposers of wood matter. And then you want your mycorrhizal fungi in the roots, and that's what an ecosystem does. So when I'm designing an ecosystem, what I try to do is just mimic them layers, and I think about them layers, because if you build in them layers into a system, what you get is lots of feedback from them layers. Because you've got small crops that might last 6 to 3 years. And then you've got your shrubs that might last to kind of 3 to 7 years. And then you've got your understory and your smaller fruit trees, which might be kind of 10 to 20 years. And then you have your big, large nitrofixing trees, which might be, you know, 10 to 30 years. And then all them layers are connected. Firstly, what happens is the smaller layers are turning over more feedback. They're living and dying quicker, and they're going through their seasons quicker. So they're adding biomass to the soil. But what happens in a larger ecosystem is the larger trees then take over. They then start developing more feedback loop and giving more biomass and more carbon to the system. And if you have a system that does that, i.e. a system which is not just one crop in one field, yeah, you have a system which is mimicking a natural ecosystem, what you end up with is very healthy soils, because that's what enables them ecosystem to do it. Soils don't emerge. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. 450 million years ago, they're very young. Soil is very young. But oyster mushrooms, fungus is very old. 1.5 billion years ago when it rendezvoused with the biosphere. That tells you something significant about ecosystems, that soil build the ecosystem and you have good soil. You don't really need to worry about the soil if you're building an ecosystem based on good photosynthesis capability, good fungus capability. Doing that, mimicking them two things, enables you to have good soil. And it would seem that that's why the biosphere has designed in the way it has designed.
Well, you know, because, you know, if we just take it down to give people, it's always good to tell people where are we and where do we need to go to. So it feels like very quickly the human race or humanity have actually broken down what took hundreds of millions of years to build by nature. But where are we now in your view? Because there's lots of predicaments and, you know, future risks looking into the future, scientists saying we are on a cliff edge, you know, the climate change, for example, and humanity is under threat in a way.
Yes. And look, I think we can't have this conversation without speaking about monoculture. Because we all rely on monoculture. You know, maybe if we look at, you know, the global production of monoculture and annual crops, you know, probably, I don't know the figures, but it's going to be more than 90% of our production globally is based on annual pesticide monoculture crops. Why is that? The simple fact is monoculture was a great innovation. It enabled us to grow huge amounts of food very, very quickly for a growing population.
Yeah.
And it did it very efficiently. And maybe you could even argue that our population wouldn't be at this scale if monoculture didn't happen. And you could also maybe say millions of people would have died if monoculture didn't happen. So, you know, we have to remember, I think the way I look at this is monoculture was a great innovation. And I don't think large corporates went into it. Yes, they went in it for money, without doubt. You know, the Monsantos and so on I'm speaking about. But I don't think, I hope they didn't right at the beginning think, actually, we know that this is going to, you know, kill the ecosystems. But actually, it's okay because it's just about money. Maybe that is the case. I'd rather think it's not the case right at the beginning. You know, it was an innovation that enabled us to grow huge amounts of food. And probably we didn't know the implications earlier. But we did. Because in 1962, Rachel Clarkson wrote The Silent Spring. And it is a book, the first major book, really, that positioned what monoculture was doing. What I'm trying to say, it was a great innovation. It enabled us to grow lots of food very quickly. But there was activists and academics very, very early on highlighting the challenges of monoculture. And the reason they call it the Silent Spring, I think we all know why it was called the Silent Spring. You know, so we won't go into that anymore. But anybody who's interested in that, it's a fantastic book. I think it is Rachel Clarkson.
We will look it up and put it in the show notes together with the interview.
So monoculture came around. It enabled us to grow huge amounts of food very, very quickly for a growing population. Years on, we now know that it's actually detrimental to ecosystems, and you know, pesticide, herbicide, insecticide, all it does is it's killing ecosystems and it's getting into our waters, etc. And, you know, if we are going to have a healthy, ecologically rich, complex, adaptive biosphere, what we need to do very quickly is transition that. And a lot of that is supporting companies, particularly food companies and large food companies, because they have the largest impact. They have the largest negative impact, but they can have the largest positive impact because, you know, that they're the guys who can make it happen, can make the transition happen. And not on their own. It needs to be a collaborative approach between governments, people, and business. But we all have to kind of work together. So the transition is huge. it is significant and huge. You know, when you think about food companies in terms of their net zero challenges, you know, and needed to put carbon back into the soil to hit their net zero targets, 2030, 2050 net zero targets, et cetera. But at the same time, they also have to operate on a day-to-day basis. You know, they have to produce food and they have to produce a sustainable business for their shareholders. And that is hugely difficult. But let's speak about the transition on the ground. I think when it comes to farming and actually food systems as a whole, agriculture and the food sector, where should we be innovating? Well, we could say we should be innovating in every section of the supply chain. And I absolutely agree. But I think if you innovate right at the beginning of the supply chain on the farm, yeah, and start your innovation from there, I think right through the supply chain, there's huge amounts of opportunity. So I'm going to speak very quickly about, let's look at I'm not going to name any companies, but let's just say Company A. Yeah. And that Company A is a large food service company. That food service company has huge amounts of waste, food waste and other waste. But let's concentrate on its biological waste. And its biological waste could be food waste. It could be cardboard. It could be paper. Lots of different biological waste within a food company. Maybe part of the transition is to stop putting that food waste into biodigesters or sending to landfill, but actually set up new facilities where we turn that food waste into high value aerated compost, high value biochar, high value vermiculture compost, high value fungus compost. Mm. Yeah. And then you take that food waste, you take that biomass, and then you put that biomass into your new regenerative organic farm. Yeah. So what you're doing instead of food waste spends huge amounts of money paying someone else to take their biomass. It is madness because that biomass has true value, you know, and that's why waste companies are doing it, because they understand the true value in it. But actually that's the food company's ownership, but they don't, at the moment, they don't want to deal with it. But in the future, Michael, what you'll see is a complete turnaround on that, because actually they are producing a huge amount of biomass, which is very valuable. And it's very valuable for their circular and regenerative transition.
I love to work with the team over at BizSimple because they are always striving to get better. 1% better every day. So I had to share this with you, because BizSimple have launched a new blogcast, which highlights some of their favorite Hospitality Maverick podcast episodes over time. And if you're new or a hardcore super fan of the show, this is a perfect opportunity to catch up with some of the standout episodes from our massive back catalog. The BizSimple team has and will be extensively transcribing interesting moments from each episode while providing some new insights on our brilliant guest, the Mavericks. There's already some great write-ups with Mavericks like Chef Chantel Nicholson and the co-founder of Singerman's Community of Businesses, Ari Weinswein. Find them at bizsimply.com/blog and click blogcast on the right side menu. Enjoy.
I'm going to keep it very simple now. For one food company has one farm. So that food company produces waste. We take that waste and we turn it into a range of biomass. We take that biomass and we feed it into our farm. So the feed into the farm is free. Yeah, because otherwise, usually you're paying someone else to take it. But we can turn it over and we put it into our regenerative system. In terms of any farm, it doesn't matter if it's a pesticide heavy farm or an organic farm, the most expensive part of that farm in terms of biology is the feed into that farm. But the companies have all the biomass to feed their own regenerative farms through their so-called waste streams. So you take that waste stream and you turn it into biomass and you feed it into your farm. And then you've got rich ecological soils or huge amounts of biomass to feed where you can build complex ecosystems, because you need a range of biomass to feed an ecosystem. And by feeding the ecosystem in the beginning through a range of biomasses, and you can develop a more complex ecosystem, then the ecosystem itself starts developing that positive feedback loop, because that's what complex ecosystems do. All they're doing is a feedback loop to generate more complexity, more life. You know, that is the role of the biosphere. Actually, it's the role of every living species. You know, when we think about a termite mound or a beehive or an ant's nest, what is it? Why are they doing that? Because they're trying to create the best conditions for life. Yeah. That's what a beehive does. And what, as stewards of the biosphere, as humans of the biosphere, I think our role in that should be to support the right conditions for life and more life. It's as simple as that. And pesticide heavy systems don't do that. Sorry, Michael, go on.
No, that's very interesting. It's just a thought that comes to me, because I was writing something. It's about leadership, but the principle the same. It's about ego versus eco. And right now, also in the food system, we, you know, as individuals, we act very egoistically sometimes and not thinking about how we actually contribute to the bigger whole. And you go back in history, ancient history, and read philosophy as well. It's all about how do you actually contribute to the greater good, not just yourself. Yourself actually come last, others comes first. And, you know, Simon Sinek has talked a lot about that in TED Talks and so on again. So it's already there, but it's like we're struggling with that food system actually to do that. And it's very interesting to talk about a food service company. Because what you're saying is that they're going to go backwards, say we're going to have less ego, we're going to contribute and be more eco. We're going to go back toward the supply chain and actually take ownership of multiple links within that, ending with the farm. The farm would be the ultimate place to be. You're actually growing your own produce in principle. So you become a closed system where you can actually feed your, in the end, the business with what it needs.
Yes, that's a huge transition to where they are right now.
Yeah.
So my work is about trying to demonstrate that, and you could say at the moment a very small scale, because it's working with food companies who have to operate on a daily basis and have very complex procurement processes and complex supply chains and so on. You have to kind of try do something out of the system to demonstrate what it might look like. Yeah, and the real challenges and opportunities of doing that. So, for example, I've got a farm. So I believe it or not, I'm a farmer in Yorkshire. I've got 90 acres, so which is, if you're in hectares, that's about 36 hectares or so on. So it's relatively small, but actually in Yorkshire, that is an average size of a farm in Yorkshire. So it's a good size to kind of start with. And on that farm, I'm doing multiple things. What I'm trying to demonstrate is to the food companies and with the group of companies I'm developing is, one of my companies called Michael Loops is looking at that upcycling. So I want to take food waste from food companies. I want to turn that food waste into lots of biomass. And then I can turn that by, and then I can use that biomass in my farm. And I can demonstrate to the food companies that by using that biomass, we can develop an ecosystem. But also, because they're food companies, we have to produce food. So on our farm, that's what we're doing. We're producing apples, pears, dancing quinces, juniperberry, honeyberry, elderberries, herbs, brassicas, legumes, cereals, grasses, and livestock as well. We have about 130 sheep on the system. So it's a very complex ecosystem with multiple activities going on. But after then we produce that food, we also need to get that food into the supply chain. And we use another company to do that called Herbalism, which will upcycle increase the value of it through fermentation, dehydration and cold pressing and produce food to go into the supply chain. So in a very small way, Michael, what I'm trying to do with the companies I work with, either the companies that I freelance with or the companies that fund my activities in terms of my farm, is to demonstrate what an intelligent, circular and regenerative food platform looks like.
And then the idea, I guess, is to scale that at some point.
Exactly. So at the moment, we our aim is to scale up to 1,000 hectares, which is what, 2,500 acres or something like that, over the next kind of 36 months. So we're hoping within, we're just looking at another 200 hectare farm just near London. We're just taking over another about 50 hectares in Yorkshire. So we're trying to scale as quickly as possible with the farming enterprise. And while we're scaling that farming enterprise, we're also scaling Microloop. So we're trying to develop better compost systems, get a full-time facility up and running in Yorkshire. And this by the end of this year, we'll also be getting our first food into sports stadiums. And when we do that, we're actually proving that we can take, we're proving the whole circle and regenerative journey. And then we scale that up with the food companies.
And then you got commitment then from food company, because they are really interesting in this, because I guess they really felt the pressure of, you mentioned inflation early on, like, food prices, Brexit, availability and so on. And besides, you have a responsibility. That's a totally different conversation. But there is a commercial reality of actually having access to food.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think, I know, Michael, that you're interviewing John Davis, in a couple of weeks, and he can speak more about this. But John, what's interesting about John Davis and Levy, we don't mind me just kind of speaking about this very quickly, is that, for example, they've just said, we're not doing any freight anymore. We're not flying, fruit and veg into the UK anymore. And therefore, John understands that yes, there is other ways to get fruit and veg into the UK, but a lot of food companies, particularly the large ones in the UK, are going to have to produce more food in the UK. It's as simple as that. And if you're doing that, the prices of them foods are going to be different, because, labor costs are different, regulations are different, and the supply chain setups are going to also cost something. So there's definitely a transition that is happening within the UK. And this is why I think the food, particularly because I work in the UK, I'm speaking about the UK. Look, if you're stopping freight and you want to transition to less pesticide heavy foods, there is an increase in costs without doubt. But also, if you're using your waste, instead of paying someone else to take your waste, and you're using all that waste to build good feedback loops, that there's a way of potentially balancing that out. I'm not saying that would exactly balance out, and there won't be any increase of costs. I think there will be an increase of costs, but I think there's new, when you've got, what I'm trying to say is, when you've got a hyper-localized supply chain, there's a whole range of new opportunities. When you're just importing food from globally into the UK, you're only getting the food. Look, if you have your own food system and it's hyper localized, what you can do is, well, you can increase the circle and regenerative activities because it's hyper localized. When you're just importing food from outside of the UK, what you're getting is only the food. And that's it. There's no opportunities for feedback loops or anything, because the supply chain is so, geographically not next to each other. But actually, if you had a food service company or any food company, and you've also got your farm and you've got your processing next to you, well, actually that circular and regenerative activity becomes a lot more easy, capable of doing.
And, I'm sitting, putting on my CEO hat, I run a food service company, and you've already mentioned an example, Levy and John Davis and his team is doing this. How complex is this to do? Because, first of all, you would think from on paper, this sounds very complex and very expensive. So I'm not sure I want to go on this journey in the current and business environment, that's not going to really benefit my own situation or what the board thinks about our strategy for the future of this business.
All right, it's an interesting one. So actually, we did a test with John Davis. So what we did is we looked at one of their this was actually in a Compass unit. Compass is the larger owner of Levy. So in Nottingham, we set up a composting system with one of their hotels. And what they found was they were saving on food waste. I think it was around, if I'm correct, about £500 per month, basically. Mm. So instead of letting someone else take their food waste, what they were doing is actually they stopped doing that, and the bill for that reduced around £500 a month. So, you know, £6,000 per year, for one hotel. Yeah. But at the same time, what they were doing is they were taking that compost. They all remember hotels and venues, like sport venues and so on, they have maintenance teams there already.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And groundsman teams and so on. And what I find through my own experience is maintenance teams and groundsman teams usually know what composting is and usually know how to do it, you know. So what I found is the transition with Levy on these, some of these tests was it was quite simple to do because the groundsmen were interested in doing it. Mm. And Levy have, and you know, Levy venues, for example, you know, they run, I think it's 13 horse racing venues in the UK, for example. They have like Aintree, Haydock, Cheltenham. They have huge amounts of green land and forest areas and so on. So what we, and that's the same with the hotels. So what we found is these venues have lots of green space that they're not using. They're also, so therefore they've got huge amounts of space for composting. If they've got huge amounts of space for composting and huge amounts of space for green infrastructure, well, that means they've got a huge amount of opportunity to grow more food on site. Yeah. And if you're hyper-localizing your production and using your waste stream to do it, it would seem that actually that the economic benefits are actually quite rich to do it. So you're right. The depending on what context you're in, you know, that wouldn't work for all food companies. But I would put my bet that all food companies, doesn't matter what, if it's retail to food service or anything in between, there will be definitely circular and regenerative opportunities that could support your business to be more sustainable, ecological, and economically viable in the future.
And how far are we actually from, you know, seeing a big move of this on this? What is your view? Like, is it now? Is it happening in the next coming years? Can we actually go and get this done? Because it seems like now you also said that a lot of the infrastructure for many is already there. They're already operating in areas or situation. Urban is a different conversation, but there's a lot of venues or sites that's actually near nature and can do things. And I've seen that with my own eyes as well, that do different things, you know, around, you know, either having herb gardens and so on. But what can they, can we really make the transition happen now? Or is there like some kind of constraints in the way for us to get started?
Yeah, I think we need to be doing more in terms of regenerative farming and circular infrastructure with food companies in the UK and globally. And we need to scale it up much quicker. But there is some huge challenges around. Firstly, food companies, particularly board of directors and so on, they're not ecosystem designers. And actually, to be very honest, they know very little about the food that's going through their supply chain. Yeah, and I always do a bit of a test on that. You can ask any kind of board of director who's interested in food. If you ask them, for example, a simple question like, what's the difference between perennials and annuals, for example? Not many managing directors of food companies would know that. And there is a significant difference in ecosystems and capabilities, because if you're dealing with just annual crops that come out of the soil every year, well, you know as well as me, Mike, every time you pull a crop out, what you're doing, you're letting carbon out and you're destroying the fungus ecosystem within the soil, which enables the more complex system. With a perennial plant, you're not pulling out at all. And therefore, in perennial systems, they tend to be more complex ecosystems. But as I was saying before, 90% of our global food supply chain is based on annuals, for example. So there's also in the UK, I think we need more actors in terms of regenerative designers for food systems in the UK. You know, farmers are farmers, and they play a significant role in the future of farming, for obvious reasons. But farmers are not ecosystem designers, and ecosystem designers are not farmers. So that's why on my farm, what I've done is I collaborated with the original farmer who owned it, Derek Greenwood. He's 80 years old now, still fit as a fiddle, still out, you know, still out every morning at 5:30 on his quad, managing the livestock for me and so on. But the reason that system works is because it's a collaboration between a traditional farmer who knows the farm and he knows the culture, knows the area really well, and an ecosystem designer. He knows how to build complexity within that farm. And the next part of that conversation is when you bring an ecosystem and farmer together, is then bringing the food partner into that and getting understanding of what the food partner wants out of it. So I think the future of regenerative and circular opportunities is more collaboration between the food companies. Not less. No, for example, I can't name names at the moment, but we're bringing three food companies together at the moment to develop a new farm in the south in London, and these food companies probably have never worked together at all. But they're realizing actually by working together, by putting a bit of money in, enables them to get a larger farm, and maybe now they've become customers of each other on this new farm. So I also think large food companies need to start working with each other much more intelligently. Yes, everybody has to have a commercial edge, but that doesn't mean more collaboration can't happen between the food companies. The idea that these food companies, it staggers me, Michael, when I bring food companies together and CEOs have never had a conversation with each other. You know, it's, you know, that competitive edge. And like you were saying before, we need more collaboration rather than just competitiveness.
Yeah, it's less ego and more eco, as I normally say. And it's super interesting when you say, Vincent, around as well, that, you know, it's already happening. There's already this positive move. There needs to be more done, you say as well. But what is, like, you know, your top learning the last couple of years on, you know, working on your different projects, working with, you know, big food service companies? Because I totally agree with you. You said earlier, we didn't even touch on that. Actually, there's a good reason to work with big food, because actually that's where the most impact, if you crack that, the most impact will be done. And I think we're running out of time, so we can't start building everything from decentralization. That's good, decentralization, but actually we need to get into where the real big volumes of food are served every day, every year, and that's in food service.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the challenges around that is around what I've learned is to try to be as flexible as possible with the food companies I work with, and try slowly move them into a position of advantage in terms of enabling some work to happen on the ground. You know, John, actually, the work with Levy is a key point to this. You know, what we haven't done, me and John, is signed huge amounts of contracts and so on to get over the edge, you know, and make things happen. Yes, we have a contract, you know, of what we're doing and what it looks like and so on. But sometimes you have to start small, you know, and demonstrate what it is and build it from there. And you get people throwing stones at that all the time, you know, saying, well, you know, these are huge companies and they're only putting this amount of money in, this is greenwashing, etc. And some of that goes on, and I'm not saying that's nothing to do with that, that's not Levy, but what I'm saying is that you have to start somewhere with them. And not all companies are going to say, you know, here's, you know, £10 million. Yeah, you know, do what you need to do. Sometimes you need to take, you know, smaller amounts of money, you know, take over a farm, demonstrate it, show them the real opportunities and challenges of it. Like I said, we do about 70 workshops on the farm per year. And I take my time out to do that. Why? Because I think it's important that the new apprentice that are coming into the company, who are going to be the future leaders, understand what a regenerative circular system looks like. It's also highly important that the financial officers, you know, understand what the transition is, as well as the board members, as well as the operational team. So we spend a huge amount of time on the farm, you know, with the food companies, doing in particular the farm in Yorkshire. All the transition, all the work on the farm has been done by the food companies, and I've done that on purpose. So they start to understand what it actually looks like, yeah, when we're designing an ecosystem. And also when they're going back to their supply chain, their farmers and their growers. For example, Michael, we grow 57 cover crops per hectare. 57. Mm. Yeah. Wow. Not two, not three, not one, not four, 57. And the reason I push that, Michael, is to prove a point. So when they go back to their growers and farmers in their supply chain and their farmer says, oh, I can't put in, you know, four or five cover crops, they can go back to them and say, actually, we've got a farm that we're investing in, and this farm puts 57 cover crops in, you know, and it's a sheep farm and it's an arable farm. So by developing a very unique, complex ecosystem that demonstrates lots of different things, it really helps them to understand what the real opportunities and challenges are when working with their own farmers in their own supply chains. Now they become the experts. The farmers can't tell, or the farmers and growers can't tell them how it is, because they have their own farm, yeah, doing something very unique and very complex. I'm not saying all farmers need to put 57 cover crops in, but what I'm doing, Michael, is trying to prove that point, that it's possible. And the farm that we have, Michael, just a quick point, is probably in one of the most difficult areas. It's in North Yorkshire, 250 feet above sea level. It's been a farm for nearly 100 years, you know, more than 100 years. And it's a very difficult landscape to deal with. So if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere.
Mm. Yeah, and it's really interesting, again, from a history point of view. I was reading some weeks ago around history on farming. Actually, the Second World War, 70% of all produce came from the UK. Actually, exactly. And that was actually by focusing back on farmland. So there's so much farmland, and there's so much opportunity within it. It's actually just, you know, you need to have some new thinking and actually, you know, be brave, be courage, and actually, you know, have courage and go out and do it. What is your top advice to leaders that are listening to this and thinking, this is super interesting, I really want to involve that in my journey of creating a business as a force for good? Because lots of intent is out there.
Yeah.
But where do we start? What is the, well, how can we start small with what we talked about today?
Yeah, so I think start right. What I would say to leaders, managing directors of food companies, start right at the beginning of the supply chain. Go and find out exactly where your food is coming from, and go and understand what systems that they are based on. I think that's the first thing to do. And then support the innovation to transition not all your supply chain, not all your farms, not all your growers, but just start with one. Start with one who have got the eyes wide open. That's why I decided to work with Derek Greenwood. Even though he was 80 years old, he's not been spraying the farm for nearly 10 years. He stopped it all because he just realized that he wasn't working with him. And all the other farmers around him were doing the complete opposite, more livestock, more nitrogen, more pesticides, where he went completely opposite. So if to leaders and the managing directors out there, go to the right at the beginning of your supply chain and find that one farmer or one grower who has his eyes wide open, who wants to transition, and go on that journey with him. Make it happen. Do it. And then from that, when you've completed that, then bring all the other farmers and all the other growers to that farm and show them the real benefits of it, but also the real challenges around doing it. If you're a farmer in the UK, You need food companies because most farmers in the UK are struggling to make ends meet. Yeah. And the food service sector is a huge opportunity for them to come out of supermarkets and look at the food service sector. I think it's really exciting. And also the food service sector is particularly looking for new products, new hyperlocalized products, new sustainable, ecological, hyperlocalized products. And therefore, farmers have a huge opportunity to kind of get on the back of that. And if you develop a more complex ecosystem, then you can access all your new sustainable farming incentives. There's 24 farming incentives in the UK that that you can get paid for. And they are very good. Agroforestry is excellent. I think a good agroforestry system, you can get about £900 per hectare payment for. You know, really good hedgerows, you know, are really good. On our farm, we're putting in 37 hectares, but we've got 57 water features, large ponds, berms, swales, dams. You get good money for that. So, you know, food companies, particularly food service ones, the good ones, want to invest in good farming and good growing systems. And farmers have got a huge opportunity to do that. And I think it is about the managing directors and the leaders in these companies to go and do one farm, go to your growers, go to your farmers, go right at the beginning of the supply chain, understand it, support the transition, and then build momentum from there.
I love that. And I think also it's really interesting you talk about in farming, there's always such a focus on supermarkets, which just get, for any supplier, gets harder and harder to make work because of the margins and the pressure they are under as well to deliver their business results. And so again, like maybe go and look somewhere else again as the farmer. Where can I actually do business where actually there is a different focus as well, and there might be some more margin to work with? There's still some commercials that need to work, but there's definitely more margins. That's my own experience as well.
Just get a quick example of that. Most sheep farmers in Yorkshire all sell to one company in Bradford. And if they're all selling to one company in Bradford, who's got the power?
Yeah.
The company in Bradford, not the farmers, you know. So what you do is you diversify that. You say, okay, as you know, we've got 5,000, you know, there's 30 farmers here, for example. Actually, in our supply chain, we have 10,000 sheep. Let's go to a new fabric company. Yeah. And let's create a new relationship with a complete new company who's developing fabrics for, I don't know, Ralph Lauren. Or something, you know, look at the new opportunities because there's huge amounts of opportunity to do it. You have to diversify them supply chains if you're a farmer. And I think it's on the farmer to look at it and don't just go with a status quo. Just one other thing as well. I think when you're designing ecosystems and when you're designing farms, there's only one rule. The rule is diversity rules. That's the only rule. You know, we need more complex ecosystems to do many, many things.
Love that. That's a very great place to end a conversation that could go on for many, many hours, because as you said from the outset, this is a very complex, you know, conversation, but actually it's necessary to start having these conversations and take the deep dive and actually understand actually we can actually all do something. We can all participate, especially in food service and hospitality. There's huge possibility to actually be more involved in the supply chain. And I actually think that is happening. And I see, you know, you mentioned Levy, that there's lots of intent, but it's more the how to. And I think it's great to listen to you and the work you do. And I think also, where should people go if they want to learn more about the work you're doing, if they want to connect with you, if they want to, you know, get deeper insights into how they might get involved in this?
Firstly, I have an open farm. And I'm trying to get as many people to the farm as possible. So if there's any viewers who listen to this and they were really keen to come and see the farm, just you can either get a hold of Michael and get my email, or you can find me on LinkedIn and Dr. Vincent Walsh on LinkedIn and connect me through there. So the more the better in terms of that. In terms of ecosystems, I think one of the best designers who I work with in the UK, who's got a number of very complex ecosystems, is Martin Crawford. He runs the Agroforestry Research Trust. He's one of the guys in the UK that I learned a lot from. I've got a huge amount of respect for him. He doesn't usually do any work outside of his own farm or his own systems and so on, probably because he's got so much work happening there. But if you want to see, I you can come to my farm at any time. But also if you're in the south, in particularly Plymouth, Devon area, and you want to go and see a very complex ecosystem. I think one of his systems is about 30 years old. Maybe 40 years old now. I think per hectare he's got about 560 species in it.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. It's like Willy Wonka of the ecosystems.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is crazy. It could never be a production system because it's just so complex. But it produces a huge amounts of food and, you know, and raises the biodiversity and puts carbon in the soil. That's kind of to the extreme edge of complex ecosystems. But, welcome at my farm at any time or just to have a conversation with me. But if you're more in the south, Martin Crawford, go to one of his open days and see his ecosystems. Fantastic work.
Great. Thank you so much, Vincent, for coming on the show. I'll send you and the team and all your partners power and energy to continue this very, very important and necessary journey for our food system.
No, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
I really appreciate that you're listening. So if you enjoyed today's conversation, please share with others, rate it or give it a review, or subscribe to one of our channels because all can be done via the website hospitalitymavericks.com. I believe that reading books is key to become a great leader. So I've helped you with a curated list of some of the books that have impacted the guests here on the show and myself over the years. Find it on Hospitality Mavericks website, hospitalitymavericks.com, under the reading list. A big thank you to BizTemple for supporting us, bringing great insights, strategies, and tools to help leaders to become better every day. Check them out at bizsimply.com or on their social at bizsimply or bizsimplyhq. You can also email them directly at podcast@bizsimply.com. If you have any ideas, feedback for the show, or other thoughts, reach out to me via LinkedIn or my email, michael@hospitalitymaverick.com. I'm Michael Tinkser, and you've been listening to the Hospitality Maverick podcast show. Be Maverick.